Yeah, this talk does go in the category of unusual. Those of you who know me know of some of my antiquarian interests, like steam locomotives. And those of you who heard my talk a few years ago on permissive action links know that sometimes I'm a frustrated historian instead. Well, a few years ago, I started getting interested in old telegraph codes. Occasionally I bought one, and then eBay came along, which made it really easy to buy them. So I now have a collection of close to 50 of these things, and some of them are actually now available scanned by Google Books. So it's been a lot of fun. Now, what I did when I started looking at these things originally was just curiosity, but in some ways these are ancestors to some of the cryptographic techniques. When I started looking at it more, I realized that, well, gee, I do data networking today, and there was a stack with lots of functions. So what this talk really is looking back at the past, but from a modern perspective. I can speak of link layers and compression algorithms and error correction with today's vision of it, but applied to the actual technologies that were used 50, 70, 150 years ago and more. That's what this talk is. Now, a fair number of the slides are going to be photographs or prints from pages of actual code books. You may not be able to see that, especially from the back of the room, but the bandwidth, as you probably have noticed, into this place is not the greatest. So here is a link from which you can download the slides if you wish to follow along at home. And in a few days, when I get home and there's better bandwidth, it's an 11-megabyte file, I'll put this on my webpage as well. But this is a link that will get you the slides without overloading the hotel's connection to the internet. You know, we start our story with going back about 150 years to the dawn of a long-haul network, transatlantic telegraphy. The first cable that was laid under the Atlantic, 1853, I think it was, worked, albeit very badly. It was about a bit a minute, I think, was the actual effective data rate, and it failed after a few weeks, taking large fortunes with it to the bottom of the Atlantic. Someone else figured out how to make a transatlantic cable work. You know him today by the name he received as a reward for this accomplishment, Lord Kelvin. Figured out the capacitance of a several thousand miles of underwater cable. But Kelvin made it work, but it was a very expensive business. A 20-word transatlantic telegram in 1866 cost $100. That's not $100 in today's dollars, that's $1866. I don't know what the appropriate multiplier would be, but that, I think, the technical term for it is a really large amount of money. So there was a high premium on making your messages as short as possible. The other interesting thing that happened is that messages were no longer sealed. If you were an ordinary citizen, that is to say, not someone who would be the target of one of the black chambers of Renaissance Europe, if you sealed an envelope, sealed a letter, I should say, you had reasonable assurance that no one was going to read it before it got to its destination. Whereas a telegram, you handed it to somebody who had to read it in order to transmit it, and it probably didn't go just one hop. They had routers then. Well, they didn't call them routers. They called them relay points, which was another person who was receiving the telegram. Oh, okay, this one's going. Send this on the New York line, send it over to the New York telegraph operator, send it there. That person would receive it and say, okay, I'll send it off on the San Francisco link, and then the router in San Francisco would forward it to, say, Silicon Valley, that didn't exist then. But yeah. So people were reading your telegrams of necessity. Both problems were solved in the same way with code books. It wasn't really a brand new concept. There were two precedents. One was the optical telegraph network, especially in France in the late 18th century. Not a whole lot is known of what was done, but basically words or phrases corresponded to fairly short sequences of digits that could be sent efficiently. a better known and better documented ancestor is naval signaling flags. You know, today, an admiral will get on the secure voice network and read out instructions to a fleet. Back then, the admiral would go tell the signal officer, hoist the flags to send the following message. So I'm looking at this from four different perspectives. Compression, to reduce transmission cost. Correction. As was rapidly discovered, errors could creep into the transmission, and you needed some way to detect and correct these errors. Confidentiality, which of course I think is dearest to this audience, because this is a security conference. But the antiquarian in me really likes the comprehension. You get to understand something about a culture that's distant in time and space. The code books actually reflect the culture in very interesting ways. I'll be giving some examples of that as well. So let's look first at the naval signaling flags. Title of this slide comes from Lord Nelson's famous signal before the Battle of Trafalgar. And he used this is 1805, and he used a signaling code that was only devised about 2 years earlier. A very curious thing then. GCHQ was not dictating the secure signaling for the British Navy. Any admiral could go select any particular set he wanted. And the one that Nelson selected was by far the most advanced code ever constructed by Sir Holme Popham, because it was the first one that was flexible enough to express more or less arbitrary concepts. Older ones, going back at least 150, probably close to 200 years earlier, were the so-called sailing instructions. Sail north, sail in this formation, sail in that formation. Popham's signal flag code had not just a few canned instructions, though it had those, but it had enough words and sentence fragments to express lots of different things. He felt that admirals needed to be able to give very different kinds of instructions, one that weren't anticipated. Nelson loved that. Of course, he didn't actually use that. Nelson sent only one more signal of substance before the battle started, which was engage the enemy more closely. That was all Nelson felt was really needed. He trained his captains well. But the signaling system he used was quite flexible. Here's an example. The most interesting one here, one of the fascinating ones from a cultural perspective is NF3 is the code for ladles. I don't know why admirals needed to send signals about ladles, but apparently they did. You know, land the troops, form them, that's more interesting. Land with only arms and ammunition, great. But ladles? Okay. But the other interesting one over here, if you can't read it, troops to land with 1 day's provisions cooked, and then brackets. If more than 1 day's, it will be denoted by a numeral signal. In other words, there was an optional parameter you could give to this signal. It wasn't just the canned phrases. You could modify it this way, and you didn't need two different signals. But a limitation of any code book, Nelson originally told his signaling officer to send the signal, England confides that every man will do his duty. But confides is not in the signal book. Expects is. It could have been spelled out, but it was a shorter signal if he used the word that was in there. We also learned, by the way, that the meaning of the word confides has changed in the last 200 years. He meant has confidence that. So we see a lot of this properties of the telegraph codes as they evolved here. This page here is actually an excerpt from a very typical late 19th century code book, the Atlas Universal Travelers and Business Cipher Code. To send this phrase, you send the single word on the left, and since you were charged by the word, you could see a fairly considerable one. Now, I did not have to go send Gullery when I got here, had some trouble with the customs, or gullible baggage seized by customs, but this is the sort of thing that a traveler might want to send. A few other things worth noting. In this code book, typical of its era, it changed not very many years later for reasons I'll go into. The code words were English words or looked like English words. Gullible, of course, is. Gullosity sounds like something a hacker would invent as a word to describe the property being gullible. Gunster? Is that some NRA analog to Friendster or Napster? I don't know. The plain text was organized into categories. You know, I say this isn't collating sequence order. This is obviously not, these phrases are not in alphabetical order, but the category, customs authorities, was. So you looked in the code book for the right category and did a search more or less linear, depending on the code book, for the exact phrase or sentence you wanted to send. From a security perspective, though, this is a one-part code. It's called a one-part code. If you are trying to cryptanalyze this and you had previously recovered gullibles, baggage seized by customs, and gun stock as customs house at, and then encountered Gumby's, I bet you didn't know that Gumby's in 1896, Gumby's, you might not know what it was, but you knew it would be something to do with customs just by its place. Cryptanalysts love that, which is why confidentiality codes shouldn't use one-part codes like this. You'll also find that code books are very specialized in their area of discourse. This was a general business and traveler code, business traveler in particular. You would not use it for sending love notes to your sweetie, even by telegram at $100 for 20 words. And of course, you still have the macro substitution over here. Custom house officers seized my blank. Fill in what you want if it wasn't your trunk, which has a special word because that apparently is a more common occurrence. For numerical quantities, they were organized in the code book in tabular form. So down here on the right column, you see numbers. So, you know, 41 could be indicated by any of these different either five-letter code words or five-digit code numbers, but you use a different column depending on what it is. So one column could be for drums, boxes, or rolls, because there's not a lot of ambiguity depending on the substance you're shipping. Gallons, kilograms, sacks, or meters is this column over here. But you're not going to confuse that, those different substances. So economy in the construction of the code book as well. Use semantic differentiation to disambiguate. Code books varied widely in size. These are two of the ones from my collection. The new bow code is about 26 centimeters wide and you can see correspondingly high. On top of it is a little traveler's code. The impression I have is that some travel agency gave these out to its customers to go send messages about arrangements for hotels and shipping and I arrived safely and so on. So size was varied all over the lot. We had domain-specific code books. Every field needed its own. The explosives manufacturers had one. I really need to get a copy of that one, given the analogy between codes and weapons not very many years ago. The only copy that I've been able to find exists in the entire world is in the New York Public Library, which listed as checked out, which is rather curious because it's not circulating. So I have to go find out what's going on with that and just get a few pages of that one. But you know, theater agents had their own code. So there was a code word, disorb, meant do not want drunkards. Maybe there are lots of professions where that was a necessary code word, but this was common enough in the theatrical profession that this was in there. And filiation meant chorus girls who are shapely and good looking. Some things haven't changed. But, hey, here's a page from that. This is not just a code word for chorus girls who are shapely and good looking. There's a separate one for chorus girls who are shapely and good looking and can sing. But they're not being completely sexist. We can have chorus men and chorus men who can sing, or chorus people who can sing. Another glimpse of culture. Today, a producer might ask an actor or an actress, are you willing to appear nude? 100 years ago, are they willing to appear in tights? Hey, that was scandalous in 1905. It's worth noting that we still use domain-specific compression. Take a WAV file, take a raw picture file, and try to gzip it, you're not going to get very far. Compress it with JPEG, MP3, FLAC, any of our domain-specific compression algorithms, and you'll get much more efficiency than you will with a naive general-purpose compressor, which works just fine for executables and text, but not nearly that well with pictures or music. But this was a principle that was known 125 years ago, at least, that you could get much better efficiency by tailoring your compression algorithm, yeah, table-driven in this case, to the domain of discourse that you were dealing with. And so you had a lot of specialized codes constructed. And sometimes people in a field made up their own code, or they bought them from professional code companies. The better known code companies had their big general purpose codes, but they also had a very thriving business compiling codes for specific industries. And this was a matter of reading lots and lots of telegrams, figuring out what people were trying to say, and understanding how to express it in the best way. What's the right trade-off between the size of the code book and the kinds of messages people wanted to send? Now, they may have gone a bit overboard. There's some really strange phrases in the ABC Code 6th edition, like NBET, the captain is insane. Now, I don't know how often that message was actually sent, or by whom. Or PASG, one of my favorites. Arrived here at, macro substitution, encountered severe gale and heavy seas which carried away boats and wheel, stanchions, bulwarks, broke mast and jib boom, all sails gone. You know, how often did you send that? How often did you arrive at shore in these conditions to send that one word? And then, captured by pirates. 21 different code words dealing with being captured in different ways. And two whole pages on arrests. They may have gone a bit over. There's a great essay in the New Yorker magazine. It's reprinted in Khan on unusual words in codebooks. Khan, by the way, identifies it as the Acme codebook. He got it wrong. It's actually the ABC 6th edition. And I think that's one of the ones that Google has digitized. If you want to go read Khan and look at the codebook along the way. Most of those more unusual words were not in the ABC 7th edition, it turns out. So, which is a longer code book, but they got rid of some of these less probable ones. Yeah, well, the International Police Telegraph Code, IOL, wishes to join Foreign Legion. The Foreign Legion still exists. They have a webpage, by the way. If you need to go join the Foreign Legion, you can sign up online. They still let you choose your own nom de guerre, but I don't think it would be in anybody's police telegraph. It's important to realize that compression is always measured by a metric. The metric was not characters, because that's not what you were charged for. You were charged for words. What's a word? Is gunstock a word? Probably. Galosity? Probably not. What's a word? The telegraph companies, the international telegraph, the U.S. was pretty anarchic when it came to what was permissible, and more or less anything went in the U.S. But European countries had very strict regulations. Many of these telegraph companies were run by the government when this became an issue, PTTs, postal telephone and telegraph, when this started. And there were international rules codified by what later became the ITU, on what constituted a word. Within your country, you could say, okay, only English, only French, only German. But if I'm sending a telegram from New York to Paris, you can't say only English or only French, let alone sending one from Ottawa to Quebec. So there were rules. And they just imagine Germany, where you can concatenate to get the different words to form a larger word. You know. So they started coming up with rules. One rule said, okay, any word in any of 8 different languages, English, French, German, Spanish, Italian, Dutch, I forget what the other word, and Latin. That was the international language. And then you pity the poor code clerk in West Nowhere, Montana, who's presented with something that looks like gobbledygook, and the sender says, oh, but this is perfectly legal grammatical Dutch. I don't really underspeak Dutch, but I'll have to take your word for it. Or the corresponding one in Berlin, who's being told that galosity is an English word. It turned into a war between the code makers and the telegraph operators about what was legal. They gave up on legal words because no one could check that, so it had to be something that looked like and was pronounceable in one of these eight languages. That's pretty good. Have you seen, how about the English word strength with N-G-T-H at the end? That's not very pronounceable to many people. So they said, okay, certain density of vowels. That gave rise to a lovely paper by William Friedman, yes, that William Friedman, on analysis of just how many words one could construct with this vowel density and what the error properties would be. Lovely combinatoric analysis by Friedman, who was an advisor to the U.S. delegation at this proto-ITU conference. One of the great things about doing this talk, and I have a draft paper on it, was the opportunity to go look at these great old papers. It's also great having a major university research library at one's disposal when trying to do this. They finally gave up and said any five-letter sequence is okay. But that was partly a response to the changing technology. They went to teletypes with keyboards, no longer Morse code. And something that was short and memorizable at a glance, the operator could glance at the word and type five characters. It's easier to take five characters you could memorize than a 17-letter word in a language you don't know, but is legal according to the tariffs. But the ultimate point is compression was dictated by the tariffs, because that's what you were trying to optimize. Cost, not transmission time. They were correlated, but not the same. And why was there a three-letter code word in this police code? And all the words in that police code were three letters? Because you could concatenate three of them together to form one long word, a nine-character thing which, under the telegraph tariffs at a particular point, counted as one long word rather than three separate words, and that was cheaper. And that was perfectly legal. But when people started sending these things, as I said, they discovered there were errors. What about errors during transmission? So I assume that police telegraph code, since it was 1930, was generally sent by a keyboard. And locations, S-U-B is Vienna, S-Y-B is Jerusalem, but the U and the Y are adjacent on the keyboard. A little typographical error could send a police officer off in a very wrong direction. Imagine the expense voucher. Sir, I had to go to Jerusalem because I received, pursuing this suspect, because I received an erroneous telegram from. This was not acceptable, especially in the business world. One can speculate that this police telegraph code was not used very much by its lack of attention to error detection, error correction, even after that was well known in more general purpose codes. Morse code had its own transmission errors. Very different. Here you're not worrying about what keys are adjacent on a keyboard. You're worrying about spacing of dots and dashes. Let's take the letter F. And if I was a really good presentation hacker, I'd have click something and you hear the Morse code coming over right now. F dot dot dash dot. If the sender gets the spacing a little wrong, it could be received as dot dot space. Pause, dash, dot, which is the two-letter sequence, IN. Different two-letter sequences are ER or UR with the same four dots and dashes, depending on how the spacing is interpreted by the receiver. You're right, that should be UE. Thank you. I will correct that. Not right now, I'll correct that. That should be UE. Yeah. Or a missing dot could have drastic consequences. One case of error correction or the lack thereof reached the U.S. Supreme Court, 1878, I believe it was. The plaintiff sent the message, despot, I'm exceedingly busy, bay, all kinds, quo, perhaps bracken, half of it, mince, moment, promptly, of purchases. which was received slightly differently. Despot was received as destroy, bay was received as buy, and purchases was received as purchase. These were the facts of the case, undisputed by either the sender or the telegraph company he sued. Now, looking at this, you can pretty clearly conclude that this was a code message, set with code words, but I suspect that some people may realize that this was a mixed plain text code message, which was bad practice, known to be bad practice, commonly done at the time. In fact, this was a code this guy had made up by himself for sending messages to his broker. And he wasn't a very good code compiler, because bay was a code word, and buy is a plain text word not in his code. And it doesn't mean buy. And in fact, if you look, buy and bay differ by a single dot. So we can speculate on just how that error happened. The receiving telegraph operator missed the dot, or the sender missed the dot. As a result, the plaintiff's agent bought unwanted goods, resulting in a loss of, I think, $20,000, $20,018.77. It reached the Supreme Court, which threw out the case because the plaintiff had not requested reverse transmission. The ultimate means of error detection then was have it sent back from the far end for about 50% more of cost for the telegram, and then you could compare it, or the sender could compare it. He hadn't paid for the service, therefore the waiver of liability by the telegraph company stood. But it was all an issue of error correction and error detection, or the lack thereof. Neither the underlying link layer, the telegraph wire, nor the encoding mechanism provided adequate redundancy to detect errors. And this sort of thing became more and more serious. So a variety of techniques were adopted by the code compilers to deal with this transmission error problem. Terminal indices, mutilation tables, check digits, two-letter differences, and avoidance of common words. Terminal indices was pretty simple. You receive a word that's not in your code book. How do you look it up? Well, you know, if the beginning of the word is intact, you can go look at all of the code words beginning with those letters. But what if it was the end of the word that was intact? You basically had an index by the last few letters of the code word. If the last few letters of the code word are this, here are the possible beginning letters of that code word. They came up with a more sophisticated technique around 1915 or so, called a mutilation table. Let me see if I can zoom in on this. Here we go. Can I drag it? Yeah. Mac weirdness. If you look at, say, this would be the first two letters of a code word. If the first two letters were NS, and the third letter was a P, here is a table with the possible last two letters. If the third letter was a G, here is a table with the possible last two letters, and so on. And all of the code words were constructed according to those principles. So when you received something that wasn't in the code book, you could figure out what the possible words were with just an aid of a fairly simple, about two-page table for the whole code book. So you'd end up with about five possibilities, and then you had two choices. You could either say, retransmit, there was a transmission error, which they would do free of charge if there was indeed a transmission error, or you could try to disambiguate semantically. Depending on timing, confusion, and company policy, you could take any of those choices. This is called a mutilation table, and by about 1920, it became standard in all of the major commercial codes. Check digits. We all know about checksums. I won't go through all of the details of how it worked, but the Cosmos Trading Code from 1936 said, okay, take the letters in your code word, add them up modulo 100, and here's the check letter to append to the message, to the code word. You group together, this used three-letter code words. You group them together to get 9, and then you added a check letter to guard against transmission errors. So we had checksums in 1936. Of course, they had to be calculated by hand and didn't protect you if you wrote down the wrong letter, but you had to calculate it by hand. And apparently this was an error-prone process because one of the examples in the book shows cut and paste. This square over here is pasted over in the code book I have to deal with errors in encoding. So the error correction needs error correction, it looks like. I suspect that this was not a very popular technique, but it was available, and this was a 1936 code book. There were other examples, but they basically resolved around this sort of technique. Other code compilers tried ensuring that what we'd call today is a large enough Hamming distance and guarding against transposition errors, which are very common on keyboards. But they didn't get it perfectly. They thought they had algorithms. Either their algorithms weren't good enough or they carried them out improperly. Jim Reeds somehow compiled this list of errors in code books, in the Acme and Bentley code books. Hallan, H-A-L-A-N versus H-A-A-L-N, that's a transposition error. Those two words should not be in the same code book, but they were. Or B-E-B-P-Y and B-E-E-P-Y are just one character apart, that third letter. So there were errors in it, but nevertheless, by the 1920s, 1930s, they'd gotten pretty good at getting rid of those simple things. You cannot nearly as easily get the same principles we use today in our error detecting and error correcting codes. Go back to the 1920s. They didn't have the mathematical formulation of it, of course, but they knew what errors were common, and they figured out ways to avoid them. They also had the semantic error problem, such as people would mix plain text and code words because it's just a real nuisance to go look up the code words if you weren't very familiar with the code book and the process. A code compiler compiling especially a small domain-specific code would avoid words that were common in that domain of discourse. You would not see buy or sell as a code word in a commercial code book because that's too easily confused with the plain text word. Not everyone got it right. That little tourist code book did have words for subway, revolt, and savagery. These were code words. Maybe the class of leisure traveler in 1900 didn't encounter revolt or savagery and didn't take the subway in New York. I don't know, but it did exist. No, 1904 in New York. A little before that in London. So not all of the code compilers were quite that careful, but the better ones understood the problem and tried hard to avoid it, because people did mix plain text with code words. And the code words did give some confidentiality. The telegraph operator looking at a telegram sheet written in code, although the code book may be sitting on his or her shelf, would not, it wasn't a secret, but it was proof against casual eavesdropping. So a lot of people didn't worry about confidentiality, but some did. There were threats out there. Well, as long as you're using a code, and codes were an old notion, maybe you could use them for secrecy. The reason that Nelson's fleet was using Popham's code, even though it was so new, was that the 1799 code book had been captured by the French, so the British Admiralty had replaced the code books. So people were worried about confidentiality, and they said, we've got these wonderful code books providing compression. Can we have them provide secrecy as well? Paper letters were sealed. Telegrams were handled. The notion goes way back. The secret corresponding vocabulary from 1845, but by the way, this book was published by Samuel Morse's business partner. Great fun. I had never before had the need, for professional reasons, to go to the rare book room at the Columbia University Library, handling this, taking pictures of this, didn't have to wear gloves. I would not have been surprised if I had had to. Took a few pictures, then realized I didn't need the pictures because Google had already scanned Harvard's copy. But this is 1845. There's a little bit of compression in there. 100 phrases at the end of the book, but mostly it was confidentiality. Well, he was not the best cryptographer in the world. He said, okay, you encoded a word into a combination of the first letter and a number, and add or subtract something from the number, and that will provide your confidentiality. If you want, he suggested what today we'd call a monoalphabetic substitution of the letter. Now, I don't know how often people really needed to send the word Circassian. It seems to go off the side, but yeah. Circassian was in this code book or in their code messages, but he thought this was an important word to go put into his vocabulary. Obviously, any cryptanalyst, even an 1845 cryptanalyst, would not have had a very hard time with this super encipherment of the code. But for casual purposes, he thought it was okay. He was a lawyer and politician and businessman, not a cryptographer. But this was seen as normal for the day, for 1845. The threat models got more serious. From the introduction to Slater's 1870 telegraphic code, he notes that in flowery Victorian language that as of February 1st, 1870, the British government was effectively nationalizing all of the telegraph lines in the country. And that all these officials who've been delivering, so good at delivering sealed letters now were being entrusted with unsealed telegrams. He went on to say in great and flowery length that, by the way, the local telegraph operator may be your gossipy neighbor. Not quite those language, but about that. He perceived a threat, so he just came up with a confidentiality code. You know, the common wisdom is that people went broke selling secrecy technology. Kahn repeats this endlessly. Slater's code had a 70-year lifespan. I have two different editions, two different printings from 1890-something and 1939. For some reason, after 1939 went out of style. It encoded single words into a five-digit number. And he gives about a dozen different examples of how to super-encipher this five-digit number. It might be something as simple as an additive that you add to each number. But he says, okay, take two code numbers, permute the digits of two successive code digits, then add something to it, and then translate back into code word space. And I think against most non-military cryptanalysts, that would have been pretty secure, especially in 1870, and possibly into the 1930s if you weren't dealing with a sophisticated military cryptanalyst. So he devised something that probably was secure enough. I don't know how popular this was, but it did have this 70-year lifespan with repeated printings. And he had no compression. One word mapped to one word. So there's no savings on cost. There was no error detection or error correction, only confidentiality, and it was a product that lasted for 70 years. So clearly there was some market for it. Some people perceived enough of a threat to keep buying this thing. About the same time, Bloomer came up with the double index holocryptic code. I had to go look up holocryptic in the dictionary. Wholly hidden or secret, especially if a cipher incapable of being read except by those who have the key. Again, this was a compression code with standard phrases and words, just like in the ordinary telegraph codes. But he gave some fairly sophisticated advice on how to super encipher the code words. Yes, he talked about simple constant addition. He talked about doing transpositions. But the most interesting thing is he understood the need for a two-part code, one where the code words were not in the same collating order as the plain text. So here is a page. And basically, there are numbers down the left side. What you did over here is you wrote in your own numbers for words you wanted to send. And here, you looked up by the number on the left margin, and you had the index for what the actual code number was to look up. So you're using a different collating sequence for decrypting than for encrypting. So this was a two-part code, very unusual for civilian codes of the day. In fact, it was unusual for military codes of the day, but I'll come back to that point. One place where the threat model was very obvious was labor unions, especially railway labor unions. They had their own code to keep their messages planning strikes hidden from management. Why? Because the telegraph lines and the railroads co-evolved. Many telegraph wires were laid along the right-of-way of the railroads, used to control the railroad networks, persist to this day. Anyone know what SPRINT stands for originally? Southern Pacific Railway Internal Network. Excess capacity became what's today the SPRINT telephone company. So a worker planning a strike would send a message to his brethren down the line on lines owned by management. I don't think the labor laws at the time quite permitted it, but you know, the sufficient paranoia, they decided to have their own secrecy code. Of course, management is going to have its messages sent by possibly union sympathizer telegraph operators, so they had their own secrecy code as well. My own opinion from the examples I've seen is that labor did a much better cryptanalytic job. So here's part of the introduction to Sheehan's labor code. You know, when it's necessary or desirable to send telegrams that cannot be read by anybody, those for whom they're intended, as in the time of strikes or other important moves on the part of an organization, it's often necessary to use the company's wire to reach members of the organization. Quite explicit about the threat model. Sheehan understood some cryptanalytic principles. There were certain things. It was a code word, standard compression code with phrases, and said, okay, use a simple additive to go transform the number. But he understood the dangers of a known plain text attack. Certain things that he didn't think could be hidden, like the date the strike was going to start, he said, don't bother enciphering this. Because all they'll have to do is guess at this from the day the strike did start, go through the code book, and figure out what the additive was for that day, week, month, or what have you. So he was a bit cautious. I won't call him a good, skilled cryptographer, but he understood certain kinds of attacks. Management was less sophisticated. This was the New York Central's code, the VAND code, they called it. The entire message in cipher put the word VAND at the beginning and end. You only want to encipher part of the message, bracket the ciphertext with the words VAND. So, yeah, they were encouraging people to send mixed plain text ciphertext, didn't have additives, not nearly as good a code. Very few of the confidentiality things approached Slater or Bloomer's sophistication. Most people used the constant additive method and map back to code word space. Why'd they map back to code word space? Because the code words were the things that met the tariffs. Strings of digits were more expensive because in Morse code, every digit is 5 symbols, dot or dash. Letters were nicely compressed, you know, E, T, or one symbol each. So you map back to code word space, it was less error prone, cheaper to send, and so on. But it wasn't just commercial organizations who didn't understand cryptography. Governments were no better. This is from the US War Department code in 1904. Yeah, constant additive. And don't use 50 or 100 because those are too easy to guess. They thought about key guessing attacks, great. And what was this War Department code? It was the Western Union code, the standard Western Union telegraph code, supplemented by few hundred pages of military terms like fleet or regiment or 10 boxes of ammunition or something. But other than that, it was the commercial code, mostly for cost, but if you wanted secrecy, use a constant additive. Kahn calls this the state of the art, as I would say until about World War I started. There's got a couple of books, actually a wonderful book I downloaded from the NSA's website, 200-page manuscript, on history of American military codes. Great. So again, map to code word space, cheaper than numeric groups and error detecting, error correcting properties. One of the more fascinating things to me though is looking back in time and understanding what was going on from these code words. Khan, by the way, if you want a basic introduction to codes, as always, go to Khan. He's got a very long, fascinating chapter on the subject. He has a much larger collection of code books than mine, which is now on display at the National Cryptologic Museum outside Washington, the NSA's museum. Another good reference on the subject is the Victorian Internet, which makes the claim that the worldwide telegraph network was a bigger change to people's lives then than the internet has been to our lives, because there was no rapid means of communication then, and we do have alternatives. But Khan notes that the better a code is for a particular time, the shorter its lifespan, because technology changes, the world changes. That code word about all the masts and such being blown away was obsolete when steamships took over. But this means that by looking at a code book, you get a picture of an era. So from Unicode, you think we invented Unicode these days in the internet? No, 1897, the Unicode telegraph code. NASA, marriage has been arranged between. We don't send a lot of telegrams, at least not in the US, about arranged marriages. Same code book, Mordax, will lunch with you today. Well, that's interesting. Someone, presumably a business executive, can call secretary and say, I want to go meet with so-and-so today for lunch. Write out a message, we'll lunch with you today, hand it off to the code clerk, who'd encode it in Unicode, send a runner down to the telegraph office, transmit the message, another runner or maybe a pneumatic tube to deliver it to the recipient, goes to the decoding room and up to the executive, all in time for lunch. That's remarkably efficient. Or the China Inland Mission Code had a code number for Roman Catholic intrigue. That was the enemy. This is a Protestant missionary group in China. There are also several pages there are a lot of code words having to do with revolts, rebellions, disturbances, riots, and so on. Why? Because this was just after the Boxer Rebellion they compiled this code, and this particular missionary group was a primary target. So there are lots of code words about that, but also a fair number of words about Roman Catholics. Going back to Popham's 1803 signal code, under military and technical terms, we have not just ladles, but send women on shore to wash. Okay, so you don't have washing machines on board ships then. Okay, yeah. I don't know if the women were on the ship or they're supposed to come down from the village to the shore to wash the sailors' clothing, but that was a code word that Popham felt needed to be in the code book. Or professions in the police code from 1930. Castle keeper. Okay, I don't think that's a very common profession. It was not listed on the last census form I filled out. And boy, this is a profession in 1930. I do not know what the profession of boy consisted of. I can speculate many different ways, but that was a profession listed in the 1930 police telegraph code. Or the police telegraph code, the lists of religions, 17 or 20 varieties of Protestant and, Catholic, Mohammedan, Jew, heathen or something like that. It's a view of the world. You might also say it's a view describing their population. That code book was compiled in England. It was intended to be international. Just think, you can map a plain text phrase in your language to a code word like HKO, and a French gendarme can read HKO and, what's the French word for castle? You could, in fact, use this for the translation. There were multilingual code books. Khan describes one with 8 or 9 languages. This is the only one I have in my collection, is English-Spanish. So you get FYOYK is libel in English, but in Spanish it's difamación. So you could send these code words and people could spoke only Spanish could decrypt it. Of course, note that the collating sequence in Spanish, the plain text, does not agree with the collating sequence for English. So we effectively had to have a two-part code to do the decryptions. Not intended for confidentiality, but it was one way to communicate across international borders, across linguistic barriers, and at the same time get the compression effect of the code book. And from the five-letter code words, I suspect this was a good error-correcting code. And I don't recall the date of this one. Would have been a fairly late one, because that's when the tariffs would have encouraged five-letter code words instead of natural language-like ones. Chinese posed an interesting challenge for the telegraph. You've got tens of thousands of ideographs and a much smaller set of Morse code symbols. So in the 1870s, when the first telegraph lines were constructed in China, someone constructed a code book. A descendant of that code book is still in use today, maps every Chinese ideograph, every one of the time, arranged in a stroke radical order, into a four-digit or three-letter encoding. Why three letters? Same reason as in the police code. Concatenate three of these three-letter code words into one chargeable word to send in the telegram. You also had digits. I don't know if there's any super encipherment involved. I wouldn't be surprised. But this is still used today on official forms in China because it's a dialect-independent, unambiguous way to represent, for example, somebody's name. With the many different dialects of Chinese, this is very important. Police still use it. There's a police handbook I have from about 10 years ago, I think, which said, you're dealing with the suspect, get the name using this code book. Because this way, there's no ambiguity about what the names are. So it's still in use today. In fact, telegraphs only fell out of use in China within about 10 years ago as email and fax and cell phone took over, but only about 10 years ago. These code books were very widely available in China until about 10 years ago. Today, you just find them in places like the post office. The only one I have is a 1952 one from the People's Republic. The Chinese code book even had code points for the Latin and Cyrillic alphabets. And this goes way back. You joke that the Cyrillic alphabet came in post-revolution in China. No, it's much older than that. Here is a Tibetan code book. I do not understand the Tibetan alphabet. I'm sure it's an alphabet, not ideographs. There are about 10,000 of them, so it's not even digraphs. So I don't know what it is, but this was a woodblock made in 1949. You wouldn't think that people were still using woodblocks, but it's an interesting cultural statement about Tibet. An interesting cultural statement about Tibet today is that this printing in 1985 was done in India, not Tibet, for reasons that are painfully obvious. It doesn't show up very well in this print, but these digits are not these are four digits underneath here, and they are not recognizably Arabic numerals to my eye, even with the you can see as a collating sequence when you look at many pages. This was in the East Asian Library at Columbia University, this code book. Here's a Persian code book from about 1900. I had to go ask an Iranian student. She had trouble reading it. It's illuminated. Some of the pages had gold leaf on it. It's a cultural statement. It looked to me, you don't see it from this over here, it looked to me to have been handwritten, not printed. Very elaborately calligraphed. Very elaborate calligraphy. And it seemed, as best she could tell the student, one of them seemed to be a secrecy code book. And another one was just an encoding code book to translate the Arabic letters into the Latin alphabet that were easier to send across international telegraph lines. But this is the fact that a code book would be this ornate says something about the culture in Persia 100 years ago. This is not present in any of the American or British code books I have seen going back 50 years earlier than that. I talked about codes, domain-specific catalogs had codes. This is from the Norton Grinding Wheel catalog, a list of phrases and measurements and the code words for them. You want to order an 8-inch diameter grinding wheel, 1-inch thick of a particular substance, there'd be a code word for it. So just page on page of description of the thing and the code word for every variant. And what, but also note at the bottom over here, it says that they take, that they accept the ABC 5th and 6th edition, Libra's code, the business code, the new business code, Bentley's, General, and Western Union codes. They wanted to be responsive to anything their customers wanted to send them. You had to advertise what your form of codebook was, what languages you spoke technically, what protocols you spoke. These codebooks were expensive. Again, it's very hard to translate dollar figures from 100 years ago to today, but some of the cost was offset by advertisements. Here's an ad in one codebook, clearly aimed at a domestic use. Unify your domestic insurances. Well, yeah, most of the ads would be for business things. Again, going back to the notion of cryptography as a weapon, one of the codebooks I have has an ad on the spine of the book for explosives. I thought that was great. You have trouble exporting it today. I'd actually planned on bringing a few of the codebooks with me. Rush of packing at the last minute, I've forgotten. They're pretty heavy and pretty delicate, so you'll have to come visit me. But I don't know how to price, but an 1896 codebook cost $5 in 1896, fine. But in 1915, a room at the Biltmore Hotel could be as little as $2.50, again, according to an ad in one of these codebooks. This was a luxury hotel in Manhattan. $250 minimum for a decent hotel room in Manhattan. $500 is more likely. And the codebook cost twice that some years earlier. My guess is the equivalent price in today's currency would be in the hundreds of dollars. Small audience, a lot of work to compile. Again, cultural note, a room at the Biltmore Hotel, only 95% of their rooms had private baths. And this isn't a luxury hotel. A picture of the culture of the time. Maybe you put... None of their codes had private keys. Right, okay. But did they have RFIDs in their codebooks, Matt? And there was a confidentiality threat. The 1920 Official Secrets Act required British cable companies to turn over copies of all international telegrams to the ancestor of GCHQ, no doubt. You know, and there was an American cable company, well, it was nominally American, it was actually really a front for a British company, but had an American executive, who explained to a congressional committee that, oh, no, yeah, we know they're looking at all the codes from other countries, but they just want ours just for show. They're not really reading American cable telegrams, are they? No, it's just for show. The author of the book in which I read this described him as either the most deceitful or the most ignorant, naive person ever to testify before the American Congress. I assure you, most deceitful is a very long list. And by the way, that statement is from a wonderful book called The Invisible Weapon, Telecommunications and International Politics, from 1850 to 1950. Wonderful book. Very thin book and very expensive, but very much worth reading. The British, Great Britain was the hub of international telegraphy. They were the first to jump on it. They had the best technology. And they used it. They were the world's experts at laying undersea cables, and preferably the cables they laid, one end or the other, would be part of the British Empire. British government traffic was preferably sent by what they called the old red route, because on maps of the day, the British Empire was denoted in red. So you would send your telegram by the old red route so other governments couldn't intercept it nearly as easily. And of course, they wanted other countries' telegrams to go through the British Empire so they could be inspected for quality control purposes, I believe the phrase is. again, but you know, not speculating about the purposes, the Official Secrets Act text itself made this statement about the about government requirements. They weren't spying domestically, at least not at this level, but all international telegrams had to be turned over. We talk a lot about copyright in the internet era. Well, copyright was an issue of the day. Under U.S. law at the time of these telegraph code books, books were not protected under American law unless they were first printed in the U.S. The Berne Convention felt otherwise, but the U.S. didn't sign the Berne Convention until 1976. So someone could steal, pardon me, buy one copy of the ABC code in London, bring it to the U.S., and legally, by American law, reprint it. Or the construction of just the code words with these all these error-correcting properties was itself an expensive business, never mind the plain text phrases. You could use these words to build your own code. You couldn't import these back into the British Empire, but you could use them within the U.S. even to communicate with somebody in Britain. British publishers often resorted to printing first in the U.S. just to get American copyright protection as well as worldwide protection under the Berne Code. Even Gilbert and Sullivan did that with some of their later operettas, it turns out. So, you want to compile your own code? Here's a notice from the ABC Code. Brought to the knowledge of the proprietors that some persons have purchased a single copy of previous ABC codes for service in compiling codes of their own. The proprietors would intimate that such an operation is a breach of the Copyright Act and liable to heavy penalties, etc. So they offered a £10 reward. Again, I don't know what £10 is, but it was probably several thousand dollars in today's dollars, judging by that $2.50 hotel room. And by the way, at the bottom is the usual disclaimer of liability. End user license agreements are not just a feature of today's era. Or copyright infringement without the internet. The ABC 5th edition code was not printed in the United States of America, was extensively copied there. The genuine copies bear our name. If you the new edition, the 7th, has been printed in conformity with the copyright laws of the United States. That's to say, they printed it in the U.S. first and then in London. And so it's protected in the U.S. as well as in all countries signatory to the Berne International Copyright Convention, which includes the British Empire and almost every civilized country. Apparently, the U.S. was not a civilized country then. Interesting. This was the 7th edition, which would, I think, 1936. I have to look that up. I have it in my bibliography, but 7th edition was in the 1930s. Okay, so now let's look at this as a communication stack. We can have a plain text layer, and the codebook layer, and the link layer, which could be either a telegraph or a teletype. Now, when I gave this talk in my department to the security grad students, someone raised their hand and said, "What's a teletype?" And just discovered that none of the students knew what a teletype was. So, where's the teletype? So here's a teletype. I got it out of it. This picture, actually, courtesy of Barry Metzger, actually was taken at Bletchley Park, which is a very appropriate spot, I suppose. This is called Model 33. It's basically a keyboard, a very noisy printing mechanism, roll of paper, often with an integral modem of some sort. I've seen others with a telephone dial on the side. Paper tape reader punch here as well. The ones that would have been used earlier in the telegraph era were mechanically different, but conceptually the same. So it turns out that the three functions I'm talked about, compression, confidentiality, and correction, can be done at any layer. A little stretch. You had restricted word choices at the plain text layer if you wanted to do compression. Think of expect versus confide. Stylized sentences because you only had a few phrases available compared to what you can construct in English or French or what have you. And sentence fragments. One code book, I think it was the McNeil's Mining Code, says, okay, you have these numerical fields, you want confidentiality, and you know the ranges of these values cannot be too high. You can concatenate these two numerical quantities into one and encode it as a 5-digit number, and thereby gain some confidentiality because almost the only one field where there should have been two. And you'd even do error correction then. I forget if it was the Union Pacific Railways Code or the Swift Meatpacking Company's code. Said, okay, if you're transmitting over private wires, you don't have to use the code book because it's not that expensive, but commercially you do. But if you're sending numerical quantities, even over private wires, use the code book because of the better error correction properties and better transmission properties of code words compared to strings or digits. So we even had this at the plain text layer. Link layer, well, you avoided exposed routes. A lot of the discussion in the 1920s and 30s about radio said, hey, don't use radio for sensitive information because it's more easily intercepted by the enemy. And think of the old red route or links not on the old red route. Error correction, different links have different properties. You make different kinds of mistakes typing on a keyboard than you do with a telegraph key. And of course, compression metric was different. Because the difficulty sending on a telegraph keyboard, a pronounceable word was more important. On a keyboard, something that could be memorized at a glance and then typed, touch typed, was more important. So there's the teletype picture. Compression metrics, as I said, you're optimizing cost, not transmission time. But from a security perspective, devising these code words was an adversarial process. The code book's compiler's enemy was the telegraph company, and the telegraph company's enemy was the code book's compiler. So it was an iterative process. Every time the rules were changed, the code book compilers would find a new way to do what the operators considered to be cheating. Concatenating words. Someone once published, it wasn't a code book, it was a list of all possible legal code words against some particular instantiation of the ITU's rules. Okay, folks, here's my book. You can use all my code words. And by the way, there are 5 letters. You can concatenate to get 10-letter words. This is a security interaction. It was very much a security-like process devising these code words and code books. It's also worth noting the different security properties of end-to-end versus hop-by-hop encryption. You want to go send a code book, and you pull down your trusty ABC 6th edition. Does your recipient have the 6th edition? No. You send it to the telegraph company near their house, or the telegraph service office near their business, which would decrypt it, convert it to plain text, and maybe send it back on, either in a different code or in plain text. You send it internationally in the highly compressed form because that was the expensive link. So your compression and confidentiality and error correction might not be end-to-end. There were ads saying, okay, you can send to an intermediate point and we will do the translation and retransmission as necessary. And if you're doing confidentiality, then your confidentiality is stopping here, not here. We have that today with VPNs. You get an IPsec tunnel to your home location, but goes in plain text within your company because, of course, there are never any insider attacks or hack machines inside the firewall. Firewalls are all perfect protection. We all know that. You listened to me and Bill 15 years ago, so we protected you. You just need this encryption to go deal with the evil internet. Not a new problem. We even had the analog then to the DNS. Think about it. You're charging by the word, and what's a long address? 1214 Amsterdam Avenue, New York, New York, room 450. That's many words that I'm going to get charged by. I could register one word, and that would be my cable address. And how do you look it up? Big, thick book of cable addresses. It's actually a fascinating book, and I wish I had time to pictures of more of it. But it was organized geographically. It basically combined the yellow pages. We could look up business area and geography. Okay. And then look it up geographically. You look up, so for example, here's the code for Turin. You see that this company over here accepts 3 different codes. That's the services accepted field in the the well-known services field in the DNS, and their cable address. I don't even know what business key is. I don't remember what business key is. And the code word that you would use to transmit to this one destination. And sometimes your cable address varied with the cable company that was serving you. Sometimes there was one directory per location. During World War I, the U.S. censors didn't like this because it made it harder for these censors to figure out who was receiving the messages, I believe. Insisted on full names and addresses from the traffic analysts. So this was the analog to the DNS. You'd look up somebody's location this way and get their single short form of the address rather than, well, maybe it's, actually maybe it's tinyurl.com or something, not the DNS. So how long did this stuff last? I've got code books from Australia from 67 and 72. And from China said it was used until about 10 years ago. What we're doing today is the evolution of what was done then. Huffman didn't invent compression. Hamming didn't invent error correction, error detection. NIST didn't invent encryption. This stuff's been mathematized and formalized and improved. But the basic concept for what we're doing today in data transmission and confidentiality go back at least 75 years. Error detection, compression, and so on. So I had a few, Jim Reeves was the guy who taught me about some of this stuff in the first place. A bunch of people who speak more languages than I do help me with the various other languages. I do need to add a thank you note to the research libraries and librarians of the world who've been collecting and cataloging this stuff against the chance that someone weird like me is going to go look at it. And Google Books, so you can get, you go, the subject category for these code books on Library of Congress subject category, which Google is using for indexing is, I think it's codes and telegraph ciphers. You can look it up. There's a draft paper of mine on my webpage that I haven't given the full URL because I don't really want this that paper indexed yet by Google because it's not nearly ready. But if you want, and these slides will go up on my webpage in a couple of days, but you're welcome to download it. It's not yet a complete paper. More details and more complete bibliographic references to the various codes that I consulted. Most of the codes, books I was looking at are in my collection. Reasonable number were in the New York Public Library, Columbia University Library. It's great having access to two of the world's best research libraries. One visit to the Library of Congress. Didn't quite have a chance to visit the British Library or the Ashmolean on my last visit to England, but it's on my list of things I'd like to do at some point. And Google Books, because these things are falling apart, many of them. Any questions?
So there's a few political scientists that try and estimate the consumer price index past 1913. I think they go back to about 1774, which is, the error blows up, but I looked it up. 1896, $5 would have been about $120 in 2007 dollars, and I'll send that to you.
Yeah, I tried finding suitable references. You know, exactly how you measure is going to depend on what basket you choose for different things.
The error bars might
be. I certainly believe the $5 for 120. That's perfect.
Yeah, I think the error is 20%.
It's certainly within the error realm. Prices. Hotel prices in Manhattan probably have gone up more disproportionately. One of the code books traveler's code books, does talk about engaging room for maid servants and men servants and so on also.
All right, that is
your suitable entourage.
Wonderful, wonderful talk, thank you.
So I guess about 12 years ago there was at the Newton Institute in Cambridge, there was a cryptography six-month institute. And Bob Morris was in attendance, and he brought with him something he had just found wandering into a used bookshop in London, a World War I era British Navy code book.
Oh, wow.
And it had the nice property that commercial code books didn't have. Many of the commercial code books, the code word would be alphabetical,
right,
and the plain text would also be alphabetical.
Right.
And so there was a lot of entropy lost there. This did not have that property. They were all mixed up, so it had to be indexed and then reverse indexed again. What we found was that one night, I forget who it was, picked up the book at tea and just started reading a list of code words. And after a little while, it started to be very poetic. And so every day at tea, somebody would pick up the book and just read down the list of code words. And we noticed every now and then, not only did it sound poetic, it really was poetic. And so we finally started looking a little more closely at this book, and we found, you know, some of it was just sort of random collections of words, but whoever compiled the book had a literary streak and would or a lazy streak and would occasionally just use real poetry. We were able to identify some of it to compile their code words. So some of these secure codes were only as secure as the people compiling them, it turns out.
That's cool. That's a great story. There was... of course, the Russian one-time pads, or the two-time pads recovered by the Venona project, one of the things they discovered in analysis was that even these digit groups were not random. They apparently were done by somebody pecking at a typewriter, and people are not very good at random digits. So, that's great. That's great, Matt. Anything else? If not, thanks for coming.